We treated that as a new complaint. We went back in then on the 28th to begin an investigation as a new investigation. I'd like to highlight a couple of points in the timeline that's in front of you. On the 18th of February, the investigators met with the Minneapolis police officer to talk about backgrounds of sexual offenders. And at that point, then, we are told that there is a second admission on the 17th, and that is what triggers the second investigation then. So we have two going on at the same time. Then as we, the next area that I would call your attention to is the 3104, where we request information from the Attorney General's office regarding notification requirements. That was general information that we were looking for in terms of responsibility regarding that. It is also shortly after that that the Administrator of Concordia tells us that the police had been in the facility, had done an investigation around the first vulnerable adult report, and that her statement was that they had not found any evidence of assault. We then, going back into the current investigation, not the vulnerable adult one, we draft the deficiencies. We do have then the meeting with corrections to talk about what was going on at Concordia. We issue a final report on April 8th, and by that time, three of the residents that are identified in the report are either discharged prior to the start of the investigation or during the course of the investigation. The report then is filed with all the appropriate people that are required. The final thing I would like to highlight, just as a bit of ongoing to address any concerns about where we are today, would be the entry of 52804. We were in last Friday as a follow-up visit, part of the normal procedure. We did, at this particular time, last Friday evening, late afternoon, we issued an immediate jeopardy situation to the Concordia home. This is the highest sanction that we can do. And that was a result of indications and statements and documentation that the home failed to supervise the residents. It did not relate to any individuals there that were labeled sexual offenders. It was a general statement of failure to monitor and secure safety for their residents. I just wanted that to be cited, since that is kind of the state of affairs today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Did Mr. Triple have anything to add? Are there questions for the Commissioner or for Mike Triple this morning? I hope every member has a copy of this timeline, investigative timeline, that does help to follow the points that the Commissioner's made.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, looking at this sheet that you prepared with the timeline, four pages, reference starting with April 8 and working back, just a couple of questions. The April 8 was a final report, I believe you referenced, and that you said was filed with the appropriate persons or parties. Is that correct? And if so, who are those persons? Who was it filed with on April 8th, final report? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, that is indicated that the cover letter and deficiencies were sent to the facility. They're also copied then to the Ombudsman, to the Hennepin County Social Services Licensing Certification, DHS, the Region 5 office, as listed there on April 8th.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, the first report that you received and where there was a report made and an investigation made and then a report filed by your office, what was that date and who was that filed with as well?
The first Mr. Chairman, the first report that we received would have been the vulnerable adult report. That is the one we received on November 12th. That was a self-report from the facility according to the requirements of the Vulnerable Adult Act. So that would be the first report. The second report that we received was the anonymous letter, and that's the letter that we received in our office on January 26th.
Chairman Smith.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Triple?
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative, the first report, since it was a vulnerable adult report, when we complete those investigations, those reports, in addition to going to the facility and their representatives, do go to the Ombudsman. They would go to the Medicaid Fraud Unit of the Attorney General's Office, to the Legislative, you know, Reference Library. There is a difference in how we would be handling our complaint reports. Anything relating to the vulnerable adults law does go through those procedures. The second two reports were general complaints focusing on resident right issues. Those would have gone to a number of parties. They would not have gone to the Attorney General's office.
And Mr. Triple, does that include the first report that came in on November 12th?
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, yes, that first report on November 12th, the self-report from the facility, that investigative report, the last two numbers, 34, would have gone to the Ombudsman, to the Attorney General's office, as we indicated on that timeline.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Triple,
Smith.
Tell me the date again and what report that was and that went to the Attorney General as well. What was the date and what was that report?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the report that we completed on the 5th of February would have been distributed to the individuals listed in that bottom paragraph on a timeline a day or two after that report. We would not necessarily have the dates, but as part of our automatic processing, that would have been sent out to the individuals identified one or two days later after the date of February 5th.
So, Mr. Triple, the February 5, is that the first date? On that date or within a day or two, I've just heard you say the Attorney General's office was notified of the report. Is that correct?
Madam Mr. Chair, Triple. Representative Smith, the Attorney General's office would have received a copy of that report a few days after the February 5th date.
Chairman Smith.
Mr. Triple, one last question then on this issue of notification. Did the Attorney General's office receive any notice of any other reports prior to the 5th, and if so, when?
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, prior to the 5th of February, the normal routine of our office would be to forward any vulnerable adult complaints to the Attorney General's office. I don't have specifics as to what would be transmitted, you know, prior to the, you know, 5th of February, but any report done under the Vulnerable Adults Act automatically goes to the Attorney General's office. I could try to find that information for you.
Mr. Triple, I think you'll have...
Representative Smith.
I think I would like you to do that, but then what I've just heard you say is that that first vulnerable report, adult report that you received or dated or whatever on November 12th, your normal course of process would have been to send a copy of that to the Attorney General's office. Is that right?
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, once that report is completed, it goes to the Attorney General's office.
So I can assume, Mr. Triple, that from your testimony that the Attorney General's office has been apprised of these proceedings since the first part of November.
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the Attorney General would not have been notified at the time we received the self-report in November. They would have gotten the final public report in early February.
Representative Paymark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I misunderstood, I think, some of your earlier testimony, Commissioner, about the process or the procedure for nursing homes admitting people into their facilities and what the actual policy is. The issue of sex offenders and being admitted into Concordia Was the department aware that sex offenders were being housed there?
Commissioner Mandernot.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, to my knowledge, the department did not know until the time of the complaint that we had sex offenders there. I would need to validate that with department personnel, but it's my understanding that we did not have that knowledge.
Let me ask this, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Paymer.
Then does the department know, or was it the department's policy to allow nursing homes throughout the state of Minnesota to accept sex offenders into their facility?
Mr. Mandernot.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, again, we go back to the fact that the department does not tell nursing homes who to accept and who not to accept. That is not what the role of the department is. It is the nursing home's responsibility to make sure that the residents that they accept, they are able to care for in a safe environment, both for the individual resident as well as the other residents that are current members of the home.
Representative Paymer.
I know you want to move on, Madam Chair, but this committee went through a laborious process this session, looking at the inspection process that the department uses, and providers were saying that the department was too strict, too stringent in deficiencies that were handed out to nursing home facilities. I'm just surprised that the department wouldn't have a policy on this, since you have so much oversight over nursing homes, and that the federal government wouldn't actually have some kind of directive to nursing homes, since so much federal money comes into providing the budgets for nursing homes, that there wouldn't be some kind of policy, that this would just make common sense that you don't put sex offenders in nursing homes. So if that's not the policy, what is the intent of the department to rectify this to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Commissioner Mandernot, perhaps you could clarify your policies.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, again, when we look at the role of the department, we are responsible for enforcing the federal regulations as well as state licensing regulations. At this point, there is no federal regulation that prohibits or addresses the issue of sexual offenders in nursing home situations. We don't have the authority to take a look at that. There is no jurisdiction given to us for that.
Representative Paymer.
So you're saying that unless the federal government acts, the state of Minnesota and the department can do nothing, and that nursing homes can continue to admit sex offenders into their facilities?
Mr. Mandernach.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, again, I would go back to the fact that the goal of the health department in the survey process is to make sure that all residents are cared for safely and appropriately. That is the goal. And so regardless of whether the label is a sex offender or whether it is a general resident population, the goal of the department is to make sure that all of those residents are safe and that the facility takes whatever measures are necessary to accomplish that. That is where our authority is and the regulation that we take a look at. And certainly the federal regulations do require us to do that.
And Representative Paymer and committee members, that is our goal as well, to assure that all patients are safe and secure and cared for properly. And so whatever measures we may need to take to assure that, that's what we're here for today.
I'm sure I would
Representative Paymer,
go ahead. That, whether it's during the interim or next session, that we consider legislation. This has to stop.
Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, who paid for the care of the sex offenders at Concordia?
Commissioner Mandernot.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I don't know that we know that, do we?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, it is my understanding that the services provided to these individuals would have been covered under the medical assistance program. Because all of these individuals, were evaluated, through the case mix process, and it's my understanding that it would have been a medical assistance payment.
Representative Hilty, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, then, Mr. Triple, does that mean that these offenders were no longer in the custody of the Department of Corrections?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I think perhaps our colleagues from the Department of Corrections could answer that with more specificity, but it is my understanding that individuals, a number of the individuals are coming through county systems. A few of the individuals were coming through the Department of Corrections, but if there was a medical release or they were at a point in their sentencing where they could be released on probation, at that point in time they would be considered eligible for payment under medical assistance, under Medicare, if that's appropriate. The federal government does have, you know, prohibitions about using medical assistance or Medicare for individuals that are still active within the correctional system, but that would not have been the case with the individuals that we saw at Concordia.
Thank you.
Representative Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions. First, what was the nature of the offense that we're talking about? What was the gravity of it?
Mr. Mandernach.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilken, the original vulnerable adult complaint, and I believe you have a copy of that in front of you, indicates that there was a relationship between two of the residents. One of them was labeled a sex offender, and the details of that are contained in the report with the last two numbers, 3434.
Okay, could you summarize what it was?
Thanks.
I'll ask Mr. Triple to summarize it.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilken,
in
our report with the last two numbers, 34, the allegation indicated that one of the residents in the facility, you know, had digital, you know, penetration by another resident who was a sex offender. During the course of the investigation, you know, we did make the determination that there was a sexual relationship between the parties. When you look at our report, that relationship, you know, was identified. Controls were put in place by the facility. Our report could not, was considered inconclusive since we could not substantiate any sort of coercive action by the second resident. But the fact that there was sexual relationship, you know, was confirmed.
Mr. Representative Wilken.
Yeah, thank you. That is disturbing. I'm a little confused as to whether it was consensual or not. Another question would be, what was the condition of the offender? The purpose they were in the nursing facility, obviously they had some kind of disability. What was the nature and extent of that? And generally, I'm looking for what's the capacity to offend? Because, you know, sex offenders at some point are going to need some kind of care, some of them, in a nursing facility. And, I wouldn't say that someone who's bedridden would be a particular threat. But someone who is ambulatory would be. I'm just trying to find where on the spectrum these people are falling.
Mr. Triple or Commissioner, either one.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilken, the individual involved in this particular report, you know, did have mild mental retardation, you know, was not capable of living independently, would be considered to be, you know, mobile and relatively independent in the activities of daily living. There were some behavioral issues with that particular individual. There were concerns about, you know, some short-term memory, but in terms of, you know, physical mobility, that individual, you know, would have been, you know, mobile within the facility.
Mr. Triple or Commissioner, back to the consensual relationship with parties involved, is it true that there was some documentation of a consensual relationship between those parties? Mr. Triple or Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, in the report there was information identified by our investigator that the relationship, you know, had been identified by staff within the facility. There were discussions with the female resident's guardian or case manager about that relationship. There was initially a determination that there was some, you know, consent, and I think we have to be kind of careful about how that term is used, but in the report itself and what our investigator documented, the facility did take steps. There were specific contractual issues between the two parties that, you know, were identified, that talked about, you know, more time in the common areas, you know, no more, you know, sexual intercourse. And so there was an exchange of information. There were interventions between the two parties, with the facility and the case manager being, you know, part of that process. I think it is more appropriate for the department to make a decision that we were not seeing, you know, any, you know, coercion on the part of the alleged perpetrator. And it wasn't until later, late in November, I believe, that there was a concern, you know, about the relationship. The individual facility did intervene. The resident went on leave from the facility and ultimately was discharged after a behavioral situation at the end of December. And so what we were seeing is that there were interventions, there was information exchanged between the appropriate parties.
And Mr. Triple, did these interventions or contractual agreements, were they known by the family members of the residents? Or is this I'm sure these situations must arise, maybe not quite the same, but when you have facilities and people living in them, there must obviously be certain times when there's relationships that develop, and I'm sure that those facilities have to deal with those in a certain way. So my question is, when those are dealt with, and perhaps they're discussed and there's contractual agreements, and I don't know how it was with this case, are the families involved, Mr. Triple?
Madam Chair, members, I know a case manager was involved. I would have to, you know, find out if, you know, family members, you know, were involved. But there was a case manager for the female resident that, you know, was informed, you know, of this activity. I don't know if there was, you know, family involvement.
Okay. Representative Rhodes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I would have is relating to the testimony. I'm not sure, but it's my understanding that there's only one nursing home that had this sex offenders in their care, and that's the Concordia one. Is that correct, or are there others around the state?
Commissioner Mandernot.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is one of the questions that I believe the health department probably is not in a position to answer as thoroughly as our fellow agency, and that's the Department of Corrections. I think they would have a sense of where their people are located.
Okay. I have to wait.
Representative Ellison.
Madam Chair, just a few questions. I guess my first question is, with respect to the allegation that gave rise to this whole matter, you mentioned that one individual was a vulnerable adult and there was question of consent or lack of evidence of coercion. Isn't it true that we're talking about somebody with the functioning capacity of a 10 or 12-year-old child?
Commissioner Mandernach.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, according to the background of the individual that's involved, this was a high school graduate who had been employed as a nursing assistant prior to developing some mental handicap issues. So I'm not sure that it's accurate to say that there was a 10-year-old level. The report does indicate that the individual periodically would like to dress as a young child, as a young girl. I don't know that we have that accurate mental assessment that would label her functioning at a 10-year-old level.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ellison.
So, I asked whether the person was functioning at a 10 or 12-year-old level, and you gave me some brief resume items. But I'd like to know, do you know what the functioning level of the vulnerable adult was in terms of mental age?
Commissioner Mandernach.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, I do not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ellison.
And did you make any assessment, or is there any information that you have, or perhaps Mr. Triple has, that would give us a sense of how vulnerable this adult was? I mean, whether or not they were in they had a prior career in some other capacity or not, they were in nursing home, and they were in need of care. They couldn't take care of themselves, and I ran across a number of functioning age of 10 to 12. Do you know how vulnerable this vulnerable adult is or was, and could you share whether or not could you share with us how vulnerable were they? I mean, what do you know about that?
Well, Representative Ellison, are you asking if there are different levels of vulnerability?
Madam Chair, I mean,
categorized?
Madam Chair, if the testifier understands my question, maybe they could venture an answer.
Sure.
If they don't, I'll clarify.
Okay. Commissioner Mandarna.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I do not have personal knowledge of this individual's mental capabilities. I will ask Mr. Triple if we have any further documentation that indicates the mental capacity and which would speak to the issue of how vulnerable is.
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Ellison, beyond what the commissioner indicated, we would not be able to, you know, give a assessment of, you know, the degree of vulnerability. I think it is important for us to emphasize that all residents in a nursing home are considered to be vulnerable, that the facility has, you know, obligations to evaluate the residents in the facility, to take into consideration issues like, you know, mental age, decision-making capacity, and so that is done on a case-by-case basis. In the situation that we saw in this particular report, the individual, you know, did have mental illness concerns, spoke, you know, to our investigator. Our investigator, you know, made it very, very clear that in the conversations that they had between the resident and the investigator, that, you know, she was certainly aware, you know, of what was going on, was not particularly happy about, you know, being involved in an investigation with these concerns being identified, and so that there was, you know, some capacity in terms of decision making. I think clearly, you know, this is very, you know, soft ground, very touchy ground, but, you know, we were seeing a degree of vulnerability. And the issue, and I think it came up more importantly in the last two reports when deficiencies were issued, when concerns about the appropriate evaluation of residents, you know, were made, is that we were not seeing in Concordia situations where the vulnerabilities of the residents, the issues raised by individuals with the sexual offender past, were really being appropriately evaluated. We would expect that to be done on a case-by-case basis, and depending on, you know, degree of concern for each resident, we would expect different interventions, different assessments, different supervision to be taken to protect residents, and we were not seeing that here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Perhaps I'll direct my question to Mr. Triple. Mr. Triple, in your, I mean, did Concordia or does the department have any policies with regard to sex between residents? Is there any policy there that there, I mean, or is there any guidelines that you all require for nursing homes? Because we are dealing with vulnerable people.
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Ellison, members, there are no, you know, clear guidelines saying that, you know, sexual activity is prohibited in a nursing home. When we get to a position where, you know, there is sexual relationships, you know, from staff to residents, even if there is some element of consent, that clearly is going to be, you know, prohibited practice. As we deal with individuals in nursing homes, this is a issue of concern, you know, has been an issue of concern, considerable discussion for many years, irregardless of whether somebody was a sexual offender. In facilities, particularly that provide services for folks with dementias or mental illness concerns, there is a lot of inappropriate, you know, sexual activity that is not something that, you know, we do not see, you know, in complaints or investigations, but there is no, you know, policy. What we would be looking at, again, is how are the residents being protected? What is the decision-making capacity? What type of information is conveyed, you know, to the appropriate decision-makers? I think you'll all, you know, remember hearing stories about, you know, the residents getting married in the nursing homes, but again, in terms of facilities that have, you know, dementia units, individuals with other types of, you know, mental health concerns, inappropriate sexual activity is not infrequent.
One more, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. One more question, Madam Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Could you tell us anything about the sex offender? I mean, what was the risk level of the sex offender? Were they 1, 2, 3? What do we know about that, and they're likely to prey upon or reoffend?
Madam Chair, Representative Ellison, members, again, perhaps our colleagues from the Department of Corrections could help out on that in greater detail, but in the report that we completed, what we were identifying was level 1 and level 2 sex offenders. I think we need to be careful with that type of terminology, since the facility and in some of the facility records were actually, you know, labeling individuals 1 or 2 when that is in fact a specific determination made by the Department of Corrections. The individual that we saw in case 34 was a pedophile. There wasn't necessarily any sort of concern about a relationship, you know, with individuals. There were concerns about, you know, making sure that he was not involved with, you know, young children. But that was his particular basis. And I'm not exactly sure if there was an official level determination by the Department of Corrections or not. I would need to take a look at that report. But we were not seeing any level 3 offenders in Concordia.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to get back to the Vulnerable Adults Act. I'm not horribly familiar with it. But we've been talking a little bit about making sure that there is not sexual activity. So does the Vulnerable Adults Act ban it completely? Does it require reporting when an incident happens? I don't know whether staff can clarify that or the department can clarify that, but that would be my first question.
Mr. Triple, or Commissioner, whoever.
I think she's making me do that, Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Mr. Triple.
Members, the issue of sexual relationships and whether or not that is considered to be abusive behavior was a subject of very prolonged and very, you know, vigorous debate when we were doing the most recent substantive revisions of the Vulnerable Adults Act, which I think, if I'm remembering correctly, was in 1995. Clearly, there are some bright lines. Any sort of sexual relationship between staff and a resident of the facility, you know, is prohibited. I think there was some discussions there about, you know, what happens in a home care setting, a personal care attendant setting, where there was this prior relationship between the parties. But in a facility situation, any sort of, you know, sexual activity between the staff, even if there were allegations or indications that this was a consensual relationship, would be considered abuse under the Vulnerable Adults. Once we start looking at resident-to-resident sexual abuse, it becomes much more complicated, and we need to actually look at the vulnerabilities of the individual. Was there consent? Could consent be appropriately made? What was, you know, the harm to the particular residents? And so within the provisions of the statute, there are some descriptions in terms of some kind of the sexual relationships in, you know, 626. I would have to take a look at that again, but we were really not able to develop, you know, bright lines prohibiting sexual activity between residents. I think we also then get into resident rights issues, we get into resident choice issues, we get into situations where residents do have decision-making capacity. And when we were discussing these issues in the, you know, Vulnerable Adults Act, there was a lot of discussion about the individual rights of residents, and so we tried to balance between a kind of a harmful type of relationship, which one where there is no harm or where the parties, you know, were comfortable in what was going on. And so it is, you know, a little bit murky in terms of that, but what we would be looking at in any sort of investigation of resident-to-resident sexual abuse is starting to look at the, you know, harm factors. Was there an individual, you know, coercing that type of activity? What was the assessment of that individual to make a determination as to whether or not this would be reportable if this would be considered abuse.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of in another direction, was the Department of Health consulted before the decision was made by the Department of Corrections on whether or not to house sex offenders here? Were you consulted?
Commissioner Mandernach, I think
Madam Chair, Representative
touched on that already.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I knew that the department had said that they did not know there were people being there, currently there, but I was not certain that they had not been consulted prior to the decision to start placing people in the facility. So that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Blaine.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Mandernach, you had answered earlier that you couldn't say if there are other institutions or facilities in the state that do house sex offenders. Not all of the residents of the Concordia Care Center are sex offenders. Is that correct?
Mr. Mandernach.
Madam Chair, Representative Blaine, that is true.
Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Mandernach, was the staff and those in authority at Concordia aware that some of the residents there were sex offenders?
Mr. Mandernach.
Madam Chair, Representative Blaine, certainly administration was. They had, in fact, had discussions with the Department of Corrections about placing these people. It's my understanding that they had worked with corrections on staff training in terms of providing security to these people. How widely that message was spread throughout the staff, I'm not certain. We certainly in our reports have indications that we have staff members who did not know. So whether it was restricted to the people working on the third secure unit, the third floor, I can't answer that. Administration certainly knew.
Representative Blaine.
Commissioner Mandernach, can you tell me if the families of the other vulnerable adults who stay at this facility are aware that there are sex offenders that are also housed in this same facility?
Mr. Mandernach.
Madam Chair, Representative Blaine, I can't answer that. The only indication that I have is that not all family members were aware of it was off of the media report that had interviewed a family member that indicated he did not know. I do not know, and I don't know if staff know how widely family members were notified about that.
One quick follow-up. It seems unusual for me that the family members of vulnerable adults housed in a facility like this would not be informed of sex offenders also being housed in that same facility when we have taken efforts across the state to notify people in communities when we have sex offenders that are living in those neighborhoods. In the case here where we haven't discussed the level of the offenders who are in this facility, I find it unusual that the family members of those residents who are considered to be vulnerable adults are not have not been alerted, or that we can show that they've been alerted to the fact that that they have sex offenders living next door to them. At this time, I'll just say thank you.
Very good. Committee and members, we're going to move along to the next two panels. Commissioner Mandernach and Mr. Triple, if you'd remove from the table, I'd appreciate it, but please don't leave, because if there's time and additional questions later, we may need you. Also, there may be some suggestions made at the end of this hearing. I know this chair may have some suggestions, so thank you for your testimony for now.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll call the Minnesota Department of Corrections panel. Commissioner Joan Fabian, if you'd have a seat, along with Peter Orpett, Director of Policy and Legal Services, and Nan Schroeder, Director of Health Services. We have approximately 1 hour left for allotted for this hearing, Commissioner. So I'd like you to proceed, tell us everything you can, and probably within 20 minutes if you can. And then we'll try to get to some questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I really do appreciate this opportunity to give you the facts about our placements of sex offenders in at Concordia, and also to clarify some of the misinformation that has been given. And I've also had a number of questions from a lot of people about the Minnesota correction system and who does and does not have authority over sex offenders. And I think it really is important to just give you a couple of minutes on this, because everybody is not part of the Crime Prevention Committee. While many states have corrections, state corrections that operate the entire correction system, Minnesota is not one of those states. It's really unique in that we have a community-based correction system, and where offenders, the majority, vast majority of offenders, are supervised and sanctioned at the local level. To put this in perspective, there are currently 120,000 offenders under some form of supervision in Minnesota. Of those 120,000, the Department of Corrections has authority and jurisdiction over about 17,000 of the 120,000. The other 103 offenders are primarily under the authority of the community corrections jurisdictions in Minnesota. About 75% are under supervision in community corrections at counties. There are nearly 8,000 offenders currently residing in our prisons. We, the Department of Corrections, has jurisdiction over everyone, whether they come from a Community Corrections Act county or not. As soon as they're sent to prison, they become our under our jurisdiction. When looking specifically at sex offenders, of the 8,000 people in prison, there are currently about almost 1,500 sex offenders that are in prison. In Minnesota, by law, an offender must serve two-thirds of his prison sentence. The last one-third is sentenced or is served in the community under supervised release. And in the past few years, the legislature has passed laws that allowed judges to add even longer periods of release after they're released from prison, do their last third of their sentence on supervised release, and then add another period a judge can impose a longer sentence called conditional release. In every one of those situations, it is the Department of Corrections' responsibility. These offenders are under our authority. The DOC is responsible for offenders of these supervised release and conditional release. And right now, there's approximately 1,175 of these offenders that are under our jurisdiction. In community corrections counties, if it's a community corrections county, while it's under our jurisdiction, probation agents from those counties supervise the supervised release cases in conjunction under our authority. I think it might be helpful. Right now, we have over 15,000 registered sex offenders in Minnesota. Most of those offenders are not under any kind of supervision anymore. They've served out their sentence, and the sentence has expired. We have about 8,500 of the 15,000 that are not on any kind of supervision. DOC is probation in the counties that are not community corrections, and we provide probation supervision. We supervise approximately 1,000 sex offenders. Non-DOC probation caseloads of sex offenders who have not come to prison but are under supervision in the counties, there's 2,653. So that gives you a kind of a quick overview of, you know, there are different jurisdictions, and, you know, every sex offender is not under our jurisdiction. I think it's important to also note that prior to coming here, I was in a community corrections county for 38 years. And basically, we did have the responsibility when they weren't sex offenders or any other offender was committed to the were not committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, we had responsibility. And I think all of you know that when we did I don't know what the word is, but no longer have the state-run mental health hospitals, that a number of people were released into the community. The whole corrections department in Minnesota did get a number of vulnerable persons who ended up committing offenses and ended up in the correction system, whether at the local level or at the state level. So there has been a long tradition over 30 years in Minnesota of trying to deal with offenders of all sorts who are vulnerable, who need to be placed in specialized facilities. Now, getting to the Concordia Care Center, I think it's really important to note, I think the idea has been put out that we just, very irresponsibly placed people in a nursing home that's a long-term facility for elderly people that are fragile and that, can no longer take care of themselves. I think it's important to point out that the Concordia Care Center, although it's licensed under a nursing home, is not what anyone would look at as a traditional nursing home. This particular facility marketed itself to us saying that they specialize in treating very low-functioning patients, that they specialize in very severe mental illness, offenders with severe mental illness, as well as what you would normally look at as very serious physical problems that need skilled nursing care. The average age in this particular facility, the information I've gotten is in the late 30s. That these are individuals that all have very specific problems that need to have this kind of care. It's my understanding that representatives from Concordia Care Center marketed their facility to the Department of Corrections in 2002. As being a specialty facility with expertise in the type of individuals that we were looking for placements for. They were run with risk, they were low functioning intellectually, several of them needed very skilled nursing care as well as very serious mental illness problems. The DOC was assured by this facility that they could provide the specialized services that we were looking for to meet offenders' needs. 24-hour supervision, a secure unit if needed, individualized case plans that not only address the specific mental health and physical needs of our individual offenders, but a safety plan. They made a great big deal about the fact that they would have a safety plan for everybody in that facility, our offenders, as well as the other offenders housed with them. At the Attorney General's press conference, we were startled to hear Brian Dixon, the former employee of both the Department of Corrections and also the Concordia Care Center, say that he learned the facility was housing inmates when he recognized some of the names and faces from working as a guard at Oak Park Heights. That simply is not the case. In his staff role at Concordia, our records show that on September 5th, 2003, he came to prison to screen and interview a sex offender for possible placement at Concordia. One of our agents supervising offenders at Concordia said that she argued with Mr. Dixon about his practice of assigning a risk level to sex offenders that were in the facility. When she argued to him that they had never been to prison, so they wouldn't have gone through the process that we go through to assign a risk level. The Attorney General's lawsuit focuses on five sex offenders who were placed at Concordia Care Center. Of the five, three offenders were on probation status at Concord and had been placed at the facility by the district court at the recommendation of County Social Services Adult Protection. They were seen as vulnerable adults and had been called in. One of these three was placed at the home prior to our DOC probation officer being assigned to the case. Part of it was that in the jail, when two of these offenders were in the Carver County Jail, they were so concerned about them that they called social services in. We at the community corrections level, they have always worked with social services to try to find an appropriate placement. One of the three, and I mentioned, was court-ordered prior to any involvement by probation. Two of the five cases were prison releases under DOC jurisdiction. One of these offenders was, as I mentioned, what supervised release is. One of these offenders had served his prison portion of his sentence. We had to release him. He had a history of severe mental health problems. At the time of his mandatory release date, we were very concerned about his ability, just release him onto the street. We were very concerned about his ability to function in the community. We felt that it was more responsible to place him at this facility, who had told us that they would keep him safe, would keep the other patients in the facility safe, and we felt that that was a responsible action to take. The second offender, and this is another type of release that I haven't got into, was on what's called a conditional medical release status, which is the DOC, which the Department of Corrections is authorized to use under MS-244.05. It allows the commissioner to place an offender on conditional medical release before the offender's scheduled release date if the offender suffers from a grave medical or mental health condition that we can't accommodate in the prison. So it was that one offender that we worked with the facility. He would be on the secure unit because he was still on a prison status that we, did place him at that facility. This offender had severe physical and mental health problems which couldn't adequately be addressed. I know there were a lot of questions about these five individuals, and we do have the information if you need that. And I guess at this point I would open it up to questions.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, are there other facilities, other nursing facilities in the state of Minnesota that either the Department of Corrections or CCA refers to sex offenders, or is Concordia the only one?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have, for sure, we send them to Agua Ching. And at this point, that had never been a data element that we collected. We have, they are all under they're all under supervision. We are at the time I thought I'd have that information today when I came, but we have over 220 agents that we're trying to get this information from, and we have also been contacting the CCA agents who provide for the supervised release to get that information to you.
So, Mr. Chair, in other words, you will provide the committee with the number of sexual offenders that are in nursing home facilities in the state of Minnesota. You don't have the numbers now.
Yes, we will provide it, and we don't have the exact number right now.
And where the locations are. And, Mr. Chair, I just want to be clear so I understand. The issue of referring to a nursing home is that you can't care for them in existing facilities or that you're at over capacity. Why are they being referred to nursing homes? Is there a cost issue here? And what should the legislature be addressing?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the majority of the offenders that have been referred to any kind of, and, you know, it's not the traditional nursing home. It's a skilled care facility that we're looking at. We don't put them in with the elderly population. Most of those are supervised release cases where they had to be released from prison. We certainly have an option when they get on supervised release. They can be just put in the community under our agent's supervision, and we do have, you know, good supervision. If they require more treatment, more the type of intervention that I mentioned before, you know, they do get referred to a facility like this. On the conditional medical release, we have three of those that are out, and all of them are at Ogwe Ching.
All right, Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fabian, just so that I understand your testimony, you had a series of folks who had committed sex offenses but whom were not appropriate either because they've been sentenced to probation by the district court or that they were at the end of their sentence, that they would not be held in a prison-like facility, but whom, because of their other mental health problems, it was either the judgment of the district court or the Department of Corrections, that they would be better served in a skilled care facility than just out on the street. Have I got that part right?
Yes, you have.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Lippman. Commissioner Fabian, and do I understand your testimony that the Department of Corrections received representations from Concordia that they were a sufficient skilled care facility and that they had sufficient supervision and resources to prevent misconduct from one patient upon another patient before you ever made any transfer?
Commissioner Fabian.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much.
Representative Lippman, anything else? Representative Blaine, you're next.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner Fabian, I'll ask you the same question I asked the previous testifier. You had mentioned in answer to Representative Paymar that there are other sex offenders in other nursing facilities in the state, but you don't have that number, or but you know that there are other offenders in other locations in the state. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Fabian.
Yes, that's correct.
Do these locations, these facilities, are they aware that when these patients come to them that they are that they do have a history of being a sex offender?
Commissioner Fabian.
Absolutely.
Does the department play any role in notifying other members or other patients or their patients' families at these facilities that sex offenders are being housed with these people?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't in the past played a role in advising the families. We have given and fully disclosed all information about the sex offenders to the facilities.
Commissioner Fabian, do you believe that the families of other vulnerable adults who are housed in the same facilities with sex offenders should be notified that that there are sex offenders being housed in the same facility as other vulnerable adults?
Commissioner Fabian.
Representative, yes, I do.
Can you tell me, Commissioner Fabian? Commissioner Fabian, can you tell me then who would be responsible for notifying those families, and if that's being done or has been done in the past?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, a representative, at this point, I don't think it has been done. If it's a level 3 sex offender, but I don't think any of, I mean, I don't have any information at all that a level 3 sex offender is in one of these facilities, they would have to be notified. Under the law, level 1 and 2, they don't have to be notified.
Anything further? Representative Blaine.
Not at this time. Thank you, sir.
All right. We have Representatives Bradley, then Dempsey, then Hilty, then Johnson, then Hillstrom, and then we're going to move to the next panel. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Fabian, first of all, I wanted to make sure that we understood this because I think previously it was there was a comparison made. Why wouldn't we inform people going into a nursing home the same way we inform the community? I believe you answered, but if you could just clarify, I think at the level, the sex offender level is different for these people who were placed in the nursing home. Is that correct?
Maybe I'll refer to the...
For the record, your name, and then go ahead.
Peter Larpet. I'm Policy and Legal Services Director for the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, thank you. There's a couple of problems here. One is the fact that somebody's been convicted may be private data, and we have to be assiduous about not sharing that with the public. However, there has been a statute passed, the Community Notification Act, which would apply, of course, with the three levels of notification. In the cases that came to our attention, these alleged 5 sex offenders in a nursing home, several of them never did receive a level. They never went through the prison system. Now, so the problem is when someone goes to a care facility, who should tell the other residents and their families? That's a moral question, but from a legal point of view, the probation officer's role is to fully apprise the care facility of exactly the needs and the issues and the risks of the offender before they're placed there, and I believe that's been done in our cases.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I follow up, Commissioner, or whoever would like to answer? What was the kind of the condition of placement? I'm familiar with St. Peter where there's a civil commitment, but this is a nursing home situation. Were these also, in a sense, civil commitments that placed them there, or were these placed at sort of a recommendation?
Your name for the record. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, I'm Nan Schrader. I'm the department's Director of Health Services. One of the residents that was released directly from prison was released on supervised release. There was no civil commitment whatsoever. The other resident who was released directly from prison was there on what's called conditional medical release. And his release was due to the fact that he had severe medical and mental health problems that could be better taken care of in this type of a setting rather than in our transitional care unit or our Linden unit.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me follow up. You'd indicated, I think, Commissioner, that they were placed and you used Concordia because they claimed that they could serve this kind of population. It's a little unusual, it seems to me, to be placing younger people with mental health issues in nursing homes. And I don't know what they claim their training is, but my first question is sort of what sort of follow-up? I mean, it's one thing to have claims. But in any way, did your agency follow up to verify that what was claimed by Concordia was, in fact, their ability to actually serve?
Flip a coin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley,
Mr.
I can just briefly address that issue because I spoke with probation officers from both Hennepin County and Department of Corrections probation officer, both of whom advised me that they fully staffed
their clients to the agent, to the care facility. In other words, fully apprise them of both their psychological testing, their criminal convictions, the basis of the convictions, and the needs that have been perceived by the social services agencies. And they were given assurance that this would be a proper place, both to assure the public that they wouldn't be acting out and they could get their medical and mental health needs met as well.
Anything else? Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, what I'm wondering about, though, is that's what the claims were up front. But I don't know if it's you or the Department of Health that verifies that, in fact, the performance fulfills what the claims were on the part of Concordia Health Facility.
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I, we did look at the fact that it was licensed. We did depend on our agents going in. The two that were released were on supervised release, and that requires a high level of face-to-face contact. So we did have them going in. I, certainly in retrospect, I certainly look at the fact that we would be a lot more proactive. We're not using this facility anymore. We're looking at other options. We've been trying to, Nan Schroeder has been working for the past year trying to develop a facility specifically for corrections, cases. The other thing I just wanted to clarify was you were saying these young people being put in with older, or in a nursing home with older. Our people were the oldest that were in there. So, this is not your traditional nursing home, and I think that's a fact that really, really is important to get out there. I mean, we were well aware that, of our responsibility to look at public safety, and that's why we, put them in there. The probation people, no one's trying to point any blame at because it was court ordered. What I see it as a responsible actions on both the courts and, I think our department. And, the only one that would, it was the conditional medical release. The rest of them had to be out, and they could have been in the community, but the courts didn't do that, and neither did we. And that's been lost in all of this, and it's real frustrating.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Just a sort of conclusion, because I'm encouraged by the looking for other options, and I think that's one of the striking issues that we face in department in the human services area. Where do you set, and even for that matter, in the broader sense of serving for mental health issues? It does strike me, though, that I'm not really convinced that a nursing home setting, as normally characterized, is the place where we would send people with specific mental health needs. And as you look for and find other options, I'd be interested in sort of seeing what those look like, because I think that's a challenge for us, even a broader civilization level. Thank you.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, and you can answer yes or no, the sex offender is placed by a judge?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, in some cases, yes.
Representative Dempsey.
Okay, thank you. And what is the role of the Department of Corrections in regard to that placement?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, depending on what type of case it is, if it's a community corrections case and not committed to the commissioner, we have no role. In cases where it's under our authority, our role is to make a responsible plan to ensure that the offender is protected, that the patients are protected, and to continue to supervise the offender as long as they're under our supervision.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you talked about a responsible plan. Obviously, the plan hasn't been too responsible because we have a problem, do we not?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we have a problem, and I think that we need to look at what the facility did not live up to their commitments to us.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and a final proposal, and it's similar to what previous representative Bradley had to say, and that is we need a responsible plan to correct the problem that exists. And I'm wondering if you have a solution to that problem. One of the simplest, I would think, is don't mix the two in the same facility. Now, that might be quite simple, and that's not, but from my perspective, when you have a problem, I think what you want to propose is a solution to the problem, that this doesn't exist in the future, that we don't make that kind of a situation. And I would just end by saying maybe as commissioner you have to come forward with a solution for the problem, and I don't know whether that's going to take additional legislation or whether or not the people that are the professionals in your department can come up with a solution and do it. And because sometimes it takes the legislature a long time to get things done. We have a severe problem, it seems to me, and I'd like to see some action taking on the part of your department to see that this problem is solved.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Fabian.
Representative, I agree that we have a problem to solve, and we are already, trying to work to find a solution to it. I have been in very close contact with the Commissioner of Public Health, and one of the things we're talking about is to ensure that we do let them know if there are offenders. You know, right now we will start letting them know, try to get the appropriate ones out that should be out. Again, we're working toward getting another place that specifically would isolate the offenders from the other vulnerable patients.
Commissioner Fabian, wasn't it your understanding that you had a secure third level facility within Concordia Care Center, which is the nonprofit corporation of Benchmark Healthcare of Minneapolis, Inc., a nonprofit corporation? Wasn't it your understanding that you had a secure third floor at that site?
Mr. Chair, yes, it was.
Representative Hilty, then Johnson, then Hillstrom. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things. Commissioner, we've been focused on sex offenders, but are there other offenders, people convicted of other offenses that also have been referred to this facility or other facilities around the state?
Commissioner Fabian.
From DOC.
I have to refer to
Ms. Schroeder.
Mr. Chan, Representative Hilty, we do have other offenders at Agua Ching who are there on conditional medical releases for other crimes.
Representative Hilty.
And Mr. Chair, well, Ms. Schroeder, then would Agua Ching be the only other facility in which anyone has been placed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, to my knowledge, that's the only other facility in which we currently have offenders. Correct. If I could just
Commissioner Fabian.
Thank you. As I mentioned, that was not an element that we, collected the data on, and we are trying to do that at this point and centralize it, so let you know about that. There will be a number that are not currently under supervision that, are like any other segment of the population that, if they are hit by a car and have, a serious brain injury or something, they're probably in one of these homes that we wouldn't know about.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fielding, also just to clarify my comment, the offenders that we have at Agua Ching are on conditional medical release. And as the commissioner said, we're collecting the data on those on supervised release.
Anything further, Representative Hilding?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, Commissioner, if I understood your earlier testimony correctly, you said that of the sex offenders that were placed in Concordia, only one of them had not actually completed the sentence and was due to be released. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Fabian.
So Commissioner, then if all of these people had served a sentence under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections, how is it that they were deemed only at the time of release to be in need of care that they didn't get the whole time that they were incarcerated?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, they were getting care in prison. We have to let them out when they reach their mandatory release date. So, you know, they could be, we have the authority to just release them into the community, back into their homes or to, you know, wherever they're going to live. But we felt it was responsible because they had ongoing, you know, for years they could be treated, you know, in the prison and still have Huntington's disease or, you know, serious mental health problems that they still have when they reach that date when they have to be released. So I felt it's a responsible thing to, you know, get them into a facility that said they could provide not only for public safety, but also for the specific individual's needs.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Commissioner, who paid for the care that these people received in Concordia?
Commissioner Fabian.
Representative, it's a 50% state, 50% federal payment.
Medicaid,
right.
All right, Representative Johnson, then Hillstrom, then we're going to move along. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, this is going to be an ongoing problem, this issue of nursing home care for sex offenders, in particular predatory sex offenders. My question for you is, are there currently in place in Minnesota sufficient facilities to meet this growing demand of finding nursing care for these type of offenders that need to be separated for protection of our population?
Commissioner Fabian.
Chair, Representative Johnson. No, there aren't.
Will you be?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will you be coming with some recommendations then to deal with that matter?
Commissioner Fabian.
Representative Johnson, yes, we are looking at
this. We'll close with Representative Hillstrom at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Fabian, you just stated that Concordia did not live up to their responsibility. My question was there a contract for services between the Department of Corrections and Concordia? When was it signed? What were the terms, and can we get a copy of that?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there was no contract.
Representative Hillstrom, any further? Is that it?
One follow-up question.
Go ahead.
For that, actually. It's my understanding that apparently there's been some problems with Concordia's owner's Benchmark in the past for abuse and neglect. I was unaware of this, but the latest media attention has brought all sorts of information to light. Was the department aware of any of that? And if not, why not?
Commissioner Fabian.
Chair, Representative, the department wasn't aware of it, and I agree that we should have been aware of it, that we should have done more checking.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Commissioner, and staff. Stick around for the balance of our hearing, if you would. The next item 3 on our agenda is the Attorney General's office indicated either Mr. Hatch would be here or there would be someone present. So at this time, would the staff from the Attorney General's office come forward? We want to be fair to all around, but we also want to stay on schedule. So we have you and then 2 others, witnesses scheduled to testify with any questions from the committee, and we have 20-some minutes left. So give us your name and take about 5 minutes to...
Chairman, I'm Michael Vanslow, Deputy Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll keep my comments here brief. I'm primarily going to talk about the genesis of the lawsuit that our office brought, a little bit about the nature of the suit, and just a bit about some of the allegations and evidence we've uncovered to date in regard to that suit. This investigation, as was alluded to earlier, actually got started when an anonymous complaint was left with the Hennepin County District Court. That complaint found its way into the hands of Judge Patricia Beloy of the Hennepin County District Court. She then forwarded the complaint to a number of people in Hennepin County, and it eventually made its way into the Health Department's files, and they, as they described earlier, proceeded with their investigation. Judge Beloy was very concerned about this complaint. She normally doesn't even respond to anonymous complaints like this, but given the nature of the allegations about sex offenders living at Concordia and the conditions at Concordia, she thought it important enough to forward the complaint. We've talked to her since then about what we found out at Concordia, and I can simply tell this committee that she is absolutely outraged that sex offenders are residing at Concordia when she, on a daily basis, commits individuals, vulnerable adults, to facilities like Concordia and including Concordia, and she had no idea whatsoever that the risk that these people were being put in. In terms of the lawsuit that we brought claims under the consumer protection statutes, under the Medicaid fraud law, and also under our state patient bill of rights law. Right now, just to give you a sense of the status of this matter, as you know, we just sued it out fairly recently. We have a temporary injunction motion scheduled. The case has been assigned to Judge Ann Alton in Hennepin County District Court, and we're going to be arguing essentially two things in that temporary injunction motion coming up. One is an injunction order from the court requiring the immediate removal of the sex offenders from Concordia, and secondly, an order that they not place any additional such offenders in Concordia. Secondly, we're going to ask for the appointment of a special administrator, which is akin to a receivership appointment in a corporate context. And this special administrator will be charged with assessing the facilities at Concordia and reporting back to the judge as to whether any remedial action needs to be taken to make the place habitable and safe for the residents. Now, let me just give you a few minutes about some of the allegations and evidence. And I must say at this time, our fact-finding has only really begun. We've only been into this for a couple weeks. We still don't know a lot of what's going on at Concordia. We hope to find out a lot more about what's going on there. But we do know a fair amount because we've talked to numerous former employees, residents, family members, neighbors, et cetera, about what the conditions are and the circumstances are at Concordia. Obviously, the key allegation in the complaint is that these sex offenders never should have been placed in this facility. I mean, to put it bluntly, this is appalling. And I've yet to talk to anyone who doesn't disagree with that. It is absolutely striking that this would have thought to have been an appropriate practice. There was references to a secure unit at Concordia. I'll talk more about that in a second, but not all the sex offenders went into the secure unit at Concordia. Some of them were allowed to wander freely amongst the general population and even to leave the facility. A facility, by the way, if you're not familiar with it, is located directly across the street from a community center in North Minneapolis, and directly across the street also from a playground. As far as this locked unit on the third floor, this unit is anything but secure, and the health department's own reports confirm that. The patients move freely about from this locked unit into the general population, including the sex offenders. But not only that, in fact, you could even tell if you took a 10-second tour of the third unit of this Concordia facility that not only is it not secure from the standpoint of residents of that floor being able to go to another floor, but it would quickly become apparent to you that this is a co-ed unit. There are approximately 10 women residing in this unit along with about 22 or 24 males, including numerous of the sex offenders that we've talked about here. nothing to prevent the sex offenders from entering the rooms of the female residents. We've had reports not only of the sex offenders doing that, hovering over the beds of the female residents in the middle of the night. They go into their bathrooms. This is, we have basically, with this act, we have locked vulnerable female adults in with convicted sex offenders. Locked them in. So even if this was an impenetrable unit that was secure from being able to enter or exit, we have effectively locked the sex offenders in with the vulnerable adults. And we have had actual assaults. This isn't, we're not doing this to prevent a hypothetical problem in the future. We've articulated a number of those assaults in our complaint. We're getting more information about additional incidents as we speak. And the sex offenders that we're talking about here, these aren't incapacitated geriatric patients. They're young, they're able-bodied, they're ambulatory, and they're predatory. The victims also, they're every bit as vulnerable as any elderly patients in a resident nursing home. There was some discussion today about one of the victims of one of the attacks. If you look at the health department reports, it says that she was regarded as having the mental capacity of a 10 to 12-year-old. She dressed up in little girl's clothing. She talked in a high voice like a little child. And she carried around a doll. Now, what about the offender that attacked her? Well, he was convicted of offending and sexually assaulting two minors. Is it any wonder that he might have found that particular resident somewhat appealing to him? There was no notification given to the staff at Concordia. We've not found one person, not one, who was told that sex offenders were living in Concordia. Not the staff, not the patients, not the patients' families, not the patients' guardians, not the local community members, not the police, not the nearby school district. Nobody was notified that this was happening. And then as far as the conditions at Concordia without regard to the presence of the sex offenders in particular, it's safe to say they're nothing short of deplorable. We've heard numerous accounts of the rats, of the cockroaches, of the other unsanitary conditions, of lack of security, vagrants walking around or walking off the street into the home and sleeping in the basement, security cameras with no one watching the monitors, patients having their trust funds embezzled by staff members, other problems in terms of staff incidents, some that would, we're continuing to compile a list. Let's say right now, I won't take more of the committee's time in going into this, but the conditions, suffice it to say, at Concordia are absolutely deplorable. And that's why we're asking that the special administrator that we're hoping the court will appoint will go in and assess what's happening at Concordia and address those issues as well, not only for the victims of the sexual offenders, but also for all of the other residents. The last thing I would just mention is that we're doing some investigation of the company that owns Concordia, Benchmark Healthcare. One thing that we have found is that right in the middle of the time that all of this was happening with the sex offenders, Benchmark, the same owners who own this facility, were being criminally prosecuted in Wisconsin by the Wisconsin Attorney General's Office for criminal patient neglect arising out of assaults and other deplorable conditions at Benchmark's facility in Wisconsin. At this point, we don't know that much about Benchmark. We're trying to find out more about it, but that's something we're going to follow up in our suit as well. So with that, I'll stop my general comments.
Okay, we'll go to questions at this time, and I have a couple to start out with, Mr. Vanslow. First of all, I've got to tell you that some of what I've heard you say does not wash at all with some of the other testimony here, so I'm going to ask you some questions accordingly, Mr. Vanslow. You indicated receiving a complaint from Judge Bois.
Mr. Chairman, no. Actually, we didn't get the complaint from Judge Bois. I said it was sent to Hennepin County officials, who in turn forwarded it to the health department.
I heard you say that you received the complaint from Judge Boyce. Is that true or not true?
If I said it, it's not true. No, we did not receive the complaint from Judge Boyce. I said I talked to Judge Boyce since we initiated our lawsuit about this incident, and that's when she told me she was outraged by this conduct.
Mr. Vansel, you referenced in your testimony one of the persons being housed at Concordia speaking in a childlike voice or talking, and how this was appalling. That information is contained in a report from the Minnesota Department of Health. You started testifying by saying that, quote, your office has only been into this for a couple of weeks, unquote. I don't know what you mean by that. It would seem from the previous testimony that we heard that this February 5th report from the Department of Health, report H560303-4, dated February 5th, 2004, referencing this individual, and I'll read from it. It says, quote, that this individual, AP is referred to, was not capable of living independently, and, quote, a group home for sex offenders, day treatment, and a sheltered workplace was recommended. The AP was admitted to Concordia Care Center on July 30 of 03. This report, dated February 5th, was filed with your office on or about February 5th of this year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I have no idea whether that's correct or not. I've never heard that that report was filed with our office. In fact, what I was told and the information that I have is that one of our Medicaid fraud attorneys attended a meeting about 3 or 4 weeks ago with a number of officials from Hennepin County, the City of Minneapolis, the Health Department, and a number of other groups. They meet on a bi-monthly basis to talk about various issues that are of some generalized concern to the group. At that meeting, we were advised of the report that the Health Department, or investigation that the Health Department did, and their report about the sex offenders at Concordia. And when that happened, we began investigating this and ultimately brought a lawsuit.
Well, Mr. Vansel, again, the verbal testimony we had that I heard here today from the Department of Health, as well as the written summary of their timeline that they have submitted to this committee, dates references this report and has the date of February 6th of this year. The final report was processed and sent to, filed with, several government bodies, one which was the Attorney General's office, the Medicaid Fraud Unit of the Attorney General's office. So you haven't, I don't understand how you can testify that you've only been into this for a couple of weeks when you've had it since February 6th. Can
Mr.
you explain
Chairman,
that?
As I said, I told you what I know and what I understand as to the first knowledge that we had of this situation at Concordia. It was about 3 or 4 weeks ago as a result of this meeting. Now, I can't sit here today and tell you that our Medicaid fraud unit did not get that report at an earlier date.
Okay, Mr.
They
Vansel,
may have. I don't know.
Mr. Vansel, we're not going to do this, but if we were to continue this hearing and give you a couple of hours to get someone from the Medicaid fraud unit from the Attorney General's office to this hearing to testify as to the timeline, would someone, I'm wondering if someone from that unit would admit that this was received by your office in February of this year, so that you haven't just been into this for a couple of weeks?
Mr. Chairman, you asked how long I've been into this, and it has been a couple of weeks.
You yourself.
Could I get someone from the Medicaid Fraud Unit to check and see whether that report was received at its earlier date and time? I can certainly ask them that, and I can report back to the committee if you'd like that information.
Well,
as I sit here today, I don't know about that. I became aware of that report at the same time I became aware of the other report.
Well, Mr. Vansel, this joint committee, has a couple of major issues that we've been given and dealt, and we're going to have to deal with starting today and running into the next session, I think. The overall question is, admittedly, sexual predators and non-predators, or the rest of us, have to share the same planet. But one of the issues here is, do predators and vulnerable adults or non-predators, should they have to share the same building? And if the answer there is yes, which I hope it isn't, but if the answer is yes, then if we have a third floor secure unit that is sold to this state by a nonprofit corporation as being a secure facility, then should we as a state accept that, having them share the same building, allegedly secure? And if that's the case, we may have to start dealing with very minute issues like what should the citizen of this state expect by way of structuring their recreational time within that facility. Where is the line drawn? So, Mr. Vanslow, I just had to ask a question to satisfy myself as to what you meant by saying you have only been into this case for a couple of weeks.
True, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly as I told you before. Answer to your two questions that you just asked, I agree with you. There is a major policy question about should sex offenders being released from prison share the same facilities with vulnerable adults? We frankly believe the answer to that is absolutely not. Second question that you asked is, should the state be able to rely on representations that a unit like this is secure? And my answer to that is probably not. If you had simply seen the unit, or even if you didn't do a physical inspection of the unit, you could ask a simple question. Is this locked unit a co-ed unit? Is it secure within the unit, not as opposed to the unit and the rest of the facility? And here we would have found out from the very get-go that these vulnerable female adults were being housed within the same so-called secure unit at Concordia.
Mr. Vanslow, I'm going to conclude my own questions here. I just wanted to, in my mind, try to understand when your office became aware of this, and it would seem that your testimony doesn't bear up to the facts, that in fact your office participation in this investigation and this situation predates a couple of weeks ago. I would like to know, first of all, have you supplied this committee with a copy of the AG's complaint, the Attorney General's complaint that you've been referring to?
Have I supplied it? No, we'd be happy to do
and
that.
You will do that?
Sure.
All right. In that complaint, and in your testimony, you've mentioned the word sex, words sex offenders. I'm asking you now, in that complaint, when you reference sex offenders, is that part of the classification system that we've set up by statute under predatory notification and registration, or is it your office's labeling system in some other way?
Mr. Chairman, all of the sex offenders referenced in the complaint, I believe, are level 2 or level 1 according to the state classification system. This isn't a classification system that we've developed independently.
What? Mr. Chair?
We'll go to Representative Paymore.
Go ahead. Your point, then I just want to follow up on your question.
Go ahead.
So I'm not going to get into the argument about when you got the report and what you should have done. I guess I would like to know then if you did get the report, if the AG's office did get the report in early February, what is the normal time frame for the fraud unit to actually take action, to take legal action? Is it typical that it would take 2 or 3 months, or is that something that you act on right away in normal circumstances?
Mr. Vanslow.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, the timeline depends on a number of things, the nature of the complaint, the gravity, the urgency of the complaint, those types of issues. I'm not sure I can give you an exact timeline in terms of how many weeks it would take before we would take action. Our Medicaid fraud unit, when we were apprised of the situation, were initially concerned that this was possible Medicaid fraud. In other words, Concordia was defrauding the Medicaid system by making reimbursement claims on behalf of these behalf of these sex offenders when they were not, in fact, providing the requisite care for all of the residents. I'm sorry, I can't give you a more specific answer. Sometimes an investigation that is prompted by a complaint may take months to investigate. Sometimes it may be relatively straightforward, and it may take simply a matter of weeks.
Representative Paymore, anything else? Any other questions from members of this committee? if there aren't, Mr. Vanslo, hang around. We, I think, have two other add-on witnesses. Do we have someone from the Mental Health Ombudsman and or, well, Mental Health Ombudsman, Roberta Offheim? Have a seat.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Madam Chair, are we going to address the $7.2 million in bonding money at some point before we adjourn?
I think, Representative Paymar, frankly, I don't believe as part of any testimony or any questioning of these witnesses, we're going to have a little open discussion at the end of this committee for a few minutes, and then we'll let it fly at that point. Ma'am, state your name and then go ahead.
Chairman Boudreau and Smith, I'm Roberta Opheim, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Mental Retardation. I just want to briefly comment in general, and I will try to be very brief because of the time constraints you're in. But I'm here to comment on the practice of placing persons with mental illness in nursing homes, regardless of whether they come from the correctional system or county social services. The practice is a growing practice of placing adults under the age of 65 in nursing homes has been increasing routinely despite state policy that says we should be relocating these individuals into the community. There are a number of factors that play into this, including a lack of more appropriate community-based settings, funding constraints, and changes in the state provided services of state hospitals and other alternatives in the safety net, which I'm not disputing that practice of closing the hospitals, but I'm saying those are all factors that could lead into this. The practice of putting vulnerable elderly persons or vulnerable persons with mental illness with sex offenders with mental illness, whether they be from community jails or the Department of Corrections, is very troublesome to us because of the mixture and nature of the vulnerabilities of the persons involved. When a person is in jail for a crime, and they are also mentally ill, the jail or the prison system is responsible for meeting their physical and mental health care needs. Having said that, I do want to comment that I am a member of the Department of Corrections Mental Health Advisory Committee, and since the Stampley consent decree, I do believe that the Department of Corrections has made a number of improvements in the services that they deliver. But it's still troublesome for us that sex offenders are being placed in these types of facilities. If a person is so mentally ill that their needs cannot be met in the jail or the prison, then they need more active treatment and more consistent with what you would find under civil commitment to a state facility or other active treatment hospital type of setting. Nursing homes are generally not viewed as an active treatment setting for persons with mental illness. However, I consider that the facility has a great degree of culpability, if not more accountability, because I don't believe they should have accepted this type of person in the first place. And nursing home facilities are free to accept or reject persons that are presented to them for placement. Secondly, if more than 50% of the individuals in a skilled nursing facility are mentally ill and specifically under the age of 65, they should not even be considered a skilled nursing facility. They should be considered what we call an IMD, an Institute for Mental Disease, in which case they wouldn't even be eligible to accept the Medicaid money that is being used to house and pay for these individuals. Someone needs to be monitoring the number of people under 65 with mental illness that are in nursing homes that are accepting Medicaid money as their main source of payment. The federal government usually does this, but I'm not privy to all the various regulatory agencies that may have a piece in monitoring this. The facility is ultimately responsible to have a facility abuse prevention plan or risk assessment or safety plan and an individual plan, and you've heard that before. But the facility is responsible for making sure that staff know and understand and implement it. I've seen many abuse prevention plans that look really good on paper and would pass an inspector's purview, but very few people in the facility are trained on it or understand it or implement it on a daily basis. So I think we have a huge gap in that area. And the practice of putting mentally ill in nursing homes in general is very, very troubling. The practice has become a low-level, lower-cost alternative to state hospitals, community hospitals, in Rule 36. It may provide a bed and some medication management, but generally lacks any active treatment for mental illness. Once in a nursing home, counties are often not responsible or not required to provide case management, which means there is little or no planning for the return of this younger individual to an active life in the community. This is despite state policy and funding for relocation for persons under 65 who happen to be in nursing homes. They are becoming the de facto lifelong institutionalization that we have fought to eliminate by the closure of our state hospitals. We have just shifted people to a cheaper but even less desirable setting when, under the United States Supreme Court Olmstead decision, the counties and the state are supposed to be developing community-based living and service delivery, not just an alternative bed setting. We've worked hard to provide alternative services for the elderly, leaving many nursing home beds empty and needing, from a business perspective, perhaps to be filled. But some of them cannot live independently and must rely upon nursing home facilities. When that is true, they should not be forced to live with sex offenders and other individuals who are younger, whose needs are different, whose behaviors may be challenging, but because they have no alternative, they're forced into this living situation. The mentally ill are very vulnerable and deserve a safe place to live, receive treatment, and hopefully return to the community and not spend their days with sex offenders or with elderly whose activities, interests, and needs are very significantly different than the needs of the mentally ill, but who are younger. Lastly, persons who are criminals, but also mentally ill, need treatment in a setting that ensures that they do not reoffend, whether that reoffense is deliberate to, and they're culpable for it, or whether that reoffense is a manifestation of their mental illness. The state and society has done a good job in rethinking, recognizing, and developing small 4- and 5-bed group homes for the developmentally disabled, melding them into active communities where they just live as one more member of the community. This includes developmentally disabled persons with very challenging behavior problems. The Olmstead decision clearly requires us to do this for the mentally ill and other disabled populations. However, the state, the counties, and the public have failed to do this for our mentally ill population. The specifics of this situation, in my mind, first rest with the facility and their practice to accept this population and their failure to protect under the Vulnerable Adult Act and through their safety plans the individuals that are there, regardless of the reason they came to them. It's particularly troublesome to me that these types of facilities are marketing themselves as providing active treatment, when in our experience, that is not what happens when a mentally ill person goes into a nursing home. But it also rests with the placement agencies, the county and the state, who seem to take the path of least resistance or any open bed in their placement. Notwithstanding the challenges that they face when they have to release someone and put them out. But lastly, I think it rests with the state and the counties for their failure to develop appropriate settings for each of these populations. The line workers, the case managers, the hospital social workers, the DOC discharge planners, and even judges face daily challenges in what they are to do with these vulnerable mentally ill citizens or inmates. We must force the development of better alternatives for the mentally ill and for other vulnerable populations. The Ombudsman for Mental Health and Mental Retardation and the Ombudsman for Older Minnesotans have been meeting about the issue of placement in nursing homes of inappropriate populations even before the issue of sex offenders came to light. Both of our agencies will continue to work on and monitor this issue in the future. Thank you, and with that, I would stand for any questions.
Representative Ellison, then Murphy. Representative Ellison.
Let me just say very, very quickly that I'm not sure when exactly the AG's office got this or when they should have got it or when they should have acted, but I am very thankful that they did something about it when they found out about it. This facility happens to be in my district. I'm very, very concerned about this, and I think the AG should be commended. My question is, do you know whether the sex offenders themselves were getting treatment for their sex for their problem while they were in the nursing home?
Ms. Opine.
Chair and sorry, I can't.
Representative Ellison. Ms. Opine.
Representative Ellison, I cannot answer that question. The because the health department and others were actively working on this, we did not get the notification on the sex offenders until later in the process, and we don't duplicate the work of other agencies. We became involved because we have a general concern that there isn't active mental health treatment for persons in nursing homes, except maybe in some isolated cases. But whether or not they were receiving treatment either at DOC or at the nursing home facility, I just don't have enough information to answer that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Would it be, I could wait, but I would like to know if somebody from DOC could answer the question of whether the sex offenders were receiving any sort of treatment while they were at Concordia.
Let's conclude with this witness and any questions we have of her at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Anything further? Representative Murphy. Did you have a question?
No.
I apologize. We're going to go, Ms. Opheim, thank you. Let's go next to our final scheduled witness, Representative Larry Howes. Did you ask to address? Your 20 minutes has very quickly dwindled to about 19 or 18 or less.
Thank Representative you, Howes. Members, I'll be very brief. I've sung the praises of Agua-Chink far too long, but I would like to give you a little follow-up and a visit I had last Thursday afternoon with the governor and staff and some folks that came down from Walker, Minnesota, who happened to work at Agua-Chink, wanted the opportunity to present to the governor their plan for the future of that facility. And it kind of all happened within 24 hours of what Attorney General Hatch had came out with. The governor did assure me at that meeting that he would send Commissioner Fabian, and I've been told that she's been made aware of this, up to Agua-Chink to take a look at it. We do have two units, Unit C2 and D2, that are totally locked. We have male and female dorms that are separate. We have video cameras, fenced outside areas. It is secure. It's not as secure as a medium security prison, but it's a whole lot more secure than anything else you've probably seen in a nursing home. We also are a state facility. We do not, Representative Paymar would be glad to know that we do not need any capital investment money. We are ready to go. We have we are licensed for 353, and right now we only have 108 people there. And Unit C2 and D2, like I said, will hold 60 people, totally secure. It is very disheartening to see people like this sent to private nursing homes that don't really have the capability of keeping these people secure or separate from the general population. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I just would like this committee to know that there is a facility in the state of Minnesota totally capable of handling these people. And also the governor has gave us his word that he would, in the near future, if economics was an issue, that he would allow the staff at Agua-Chink to set forward an RFP. And my people are fully prepared and ready to do that, and willing to stand up for what they stand for and what Agua-Chink is and the work that they perform there. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howes, with regard to commitment to Agua-Chink, Do you know who pays the cost of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, when it comes, it seems to be the problem, at least from my viewpoint.
All right.
When it comes to different agencies in our government, be it Human Services or Department of Corrections, I would think, Representative Hilty, that if the Department of Corrections had someone that was released from their authority and then sent to maybe Human Services Authority, I think that's the question we have to understand or ask. Who is responsible once their sentence is completed? I would think the state of Minnesota still is, but what agency? Now, if the Department of Corrections is responsible, then I would say the cost would be, they would have to handle that cost. If they go to under the purvey of Commissioner of Human Services, then they would. But no matter where you take, whatever pile you take the money from, it is still the taxpayers of Minnesota that are responsible. Well, the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers pay for that. So I think the problem is we're having home field advantage here, if it were the Department of Human Services, Department of Corrections, and we're not communicating properly.
Mr. Chair, just to follow that up, just to get that straight, Representative House, who pays the cost for the care of the 108 people who are currently committed to Montgomery?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, a lot of funds go through there. There are federal dollars. There also, I would assume all of it does come out of the general fund in some fashion through the Department of Human Services.
Representative Johnson, then Hillstrom. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am aware that this facility has been running at a third of capacity or less. Why is that? Why haven't some of these predatory sex offenders been admitted there where the capacity to deal with these folks is already present?
Representative House.
Do you know?
Representative, those comments probably would be better for another time or an answer to that question, but it is in the broad range plans of the Department of Human Services to close regional treatment centers. And Aguaching happens to be one of those, along with Fergus Falls and Wilmer. We are licensed for 353.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative House, I just wanted to make a comment. I think the Aguaching idea is a very good one and would like to see these people in a state-run facility versus in a private nursing home. The challenge has been the money. And by putting them in a private nursing home, medical assistance or Medicaid has been footing the bill. I don't necessarily agree with that practice. I don't think it's a good idea, but I think that it's an issue that we really need to be talking about. At a time of consistently cutting the budget, which we've done, I believe, every year I've served on the Crime Prevention Committee, maybe the first year we didn't, we need to make sure that we are doing what's effective and what works. And I think that exploring your option would be a good one.
Representative Powell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. It always seems to me when people in business do different things. I'll take the example of someone who sells cars and has a staff of 10. They sell 50 cars a month, they're probably not making any money. If they sell 500 cars a month, they're probably doing okay. So if you have 108 residents at a facility, whether it be excuse me, private or public, you could probably function better and more economically if you had 208 or 308, because the cost is then borne by more. And it's spread out, and the workload is better. The staff is able to schedule better. It always makes sense. More numbers create smaller numbers.
Members, I think we're nearing a conclusion here, and we can take 1 minute or several hours to discuss the issues that we've heard or we think we've heard. But I think what Chair Boudreau and I would like to offer and do here, you know, frankly, it'd be nice. No, it wouldn't be nice if we were back in session, but it would be logistically nice, because then we could meet here 2-3 times a week and go forward with developing these issues. I think what Chair Boudreau and I would like is, and will suggest, is that the testifiers, which include the commissioners, the Attorney General's Office, Commissioner Fabian, Commissioner Mananek, Attorney General's Office, and Ms. Opheim as well, to offer in writing within the next 10 days suggestions to the chair and I, suggestions as to what they see as the problem and suggestions as to what they think the solutions are, both long term and short term. What, in other words, they might be doing within their own commissions. And we would also like to invite the members of this committee to do the same thing, to submit to the chair, Boudreaux and me, a letter, if you choose, summarizing the same thing. What's the problem and what's the solution? Then what we'll do is we'll share that back to the committee rather than having another joint committee periodically throughout the summer. And then forward, either in full, what we receive, maybe with Chair and I, a summary of thoughts as to what we've heard here today and forward them on to the governor. And I'm talking of time frame here of 10 days so we can also act. You know, we can let, and this is just me talking, Chair Boudreaux, but we can let the governor and the attorney general trade political barbs, but it seems to me we have a couple of problems that I've outlined in my questioning earlier, and that being the larger question whether predators and vulnerable people have to share the same building. We have to share the same planet, but do we have to share the same building? And if so, under what conditions and what guidelines? So, Chair Boudreaux, do you have anything to add to my request, our request?
Well, Chairman Smith and committee members, I think clearly we all should have the same goal and the same focus that we want to protect those under our responsibility, whether they would be vulnerable adults or whether they'd be the public. The safety of the public is first and foremost. It appears to me from hearing all the testimony today that there are a number of agencies, a number of whether they'd be state agencies, county agencies, local agencies, that really should be talking and working together to assure that our process for referrals maybe doesn't have the flaws that perhaps it does have. It seems that we have some challenges here to assure that safety continues. I think we, as Minnesota citizens, are very proud of that kind of history and heritage that we have with caring for our vulnerable people and providing for good public safety. But in order to do that, I think it will take some long-term efforts and maybe some continued discussions between those entities in evaluating and identifying, first of all, evaluating our process that we've been using and identifying areas of improving that. I'm hoping we can get some of that from all of you. And I think certainly the areas to look at are going to be the referrals, the disclosure, and I'm looking at it from the health side, and Chairman Smith's looking at it more from the judicial side. So if we can all work together and have some kinds of suggestions as to which areas should be more clearly discussed, I think when we come back next January, hopefully we'll have some recommendations that we can move forward and make some necessary changes, because we certainly do need to address this legislatively, but not prematurely, in a way that we've identified the areas we need to change. Further discussion? Yes.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, in addition to that, I think the recommendation is a good one. In addition, though, I think that the two of you should, I think under your name, should try to find out why $7.2 million in bonding money seems to have been lost in thin air here when we clearly have a need for it.
Representative Paymar, thanks for the suggestion. We do intend to do that. In fact, we've already started this morning with telephone calls, and we are going to receive some, and we'll share it as we get it as well in these issues. Commissioner of Health and Human Services indicated he wanted to tell us he couldn't be here today. The St. Peter facility, and I'm just repeating some of what I heard this morning, we will check it out, was intended to house people who were civilly committed as sex offenders, while the particular care center, Concordia, focused on convicted offenders. So there's, I don't know that, I think it may be a parallel issue, but not a collateral. We will take your suggestion under advisement and get the information we need. Anything else, Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I just had one question all morning, is why Human Services wasn't here when you said it's because Commissioner couldn't be here, but that's a piece of the puzzle we didn't hear anything about, and the funding for the the federal money and the MA funding is part of this that seems to be lurking out there, and yet we've had no testimony about that. Maybe if we could get something in writing.
Their staff is here. They've heard the same request we've all made, the chair and I have made, so I expect to hear back from them as well within the same 10 days.
And then if we could also have a clarification of what the federal law is about incarcerated people and mental illness, that would be helpful
all
to
right.
us, too.
Well, we'll do that as well. We have Representative Nornes, then Hillstrom, then Ellison, and then Hilty within the next 4 minutes. Representative Nornes.
Chairman Smith and Voodoo, I basically followed or was going to bring up the same comment that Representative Murphy had, because one of the recurring themes all day or all morning has been mental illness, and I just wanted to make sure that DHS is a part of this. I think that's a major part of the problem, and the two kind of are going hand in hand, and so it's a serious problem, a large problem, and I'm glad that at least we had this discussion today.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Boudreaux as well. Commissioner Fabian said that the Department of Corrections has stopped putting people at Concordia. I would hope that part of the report would be what can they do without legislative action? What does the department plan to do to correct this problem between now and January to the best of their ability? So if I could make that request as well.
That'd be good. There, you know, we have a short-term option and a long-term option. The long-term starts next January if nothing is done. The short-term they can do on their own between now and then and see what they can accomplish. Representative Ellison.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you and Madam Chair for convening this meeting, but I would like to just, I was going to say exactly what Representative Hillstrom said, is that there are administrative measures that we can take right now, and I think that they should be taken, and I would hope that this committee would be informed as to what administrative action both the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Human Services can take to make sure we don't end up in another situation like this. I'm sure they have it well within their authority to do some administrative short-term measures.
Representative Hildy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, according to my reading of the reports from the Department of Health, apparently this problem has a much greater extent than we heard testimony about this morning, being that apparently counties all over the state are making similar commitments. We didn't hear any testimony about that. I don't know that we have any. Apparently the Department of Health doesn't keep track of this in any way, and I don't know that we know at this point how many other offenders are committed in this way or to where. And I would hope that the committee could get some information about the extent of this with other units of government other than DOC.
Good point. Chair, one of our recommendations, that's correct. Chair Boudreaux and I clearly, within the constraints of our committee budget and within constraints of everyone's ability to even get here during an interim, can't reserve the right and the obligation to call additional hearings on this throughout the rest of the year. Let's take the lemon that we've been given and make lemonade. Maybe we can actually in the next 10 days come up with some clear suggestions that would be devoid of the political harangue we might throw at each other during a committee hearing or during a session. Maybe we can actually come up with some good proposals that we can forward to each other and then on to the governor and get this resolved. Chair Boudreaux, anything else?
Representative Smith, I'm just hopeful that what recommendations we will be listing will send around to all of you and you can add to it, and hopefully we can do this together.
There's nothing further. This committee is adjourned.